In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a really interesting conversation with Callum Cameron, an Aussie based in Estonia, which is the world's first digital society and Europe's favourite startup ecosystem. Responding to the COVID-19 lockdown in Estonia, Cameron helped trigger the Hack the Crisis movement and was an organiser of the Global Hackathon, which combined connected more than 250,000 people from over 100 countries to develop and implement immediate solutions to the crises, which we talk about in this episode. We start by discussing Callum's background in IT, helping the financial services digitise, and how he came to be in Estonia. Cameron then shares with us a brief history of Estonia and why they focused heavily on digitisation in the 1990s, plus some of the interesting ways that manifests, like their digital citizen or e-residency program. Callum tells us how he got to be in the smart community space and why a diverse cross-section from society is so important in getting different perspectives and different skill sets to best leverage the technology that's out there to solve community problems. We talk about how smart concepts are understood by the general public in Estonia, including how data sharing works between agencies to make renewing your driver's license a smooth process. Callum and I talk about the importance of trust and the social license to operate in digital societies, and how both public and private sectors in Estonia have intentionally invested in the affordability and reliability of digital infrastructure, as well as dedicated digital education and engagement programs to improve digital literacy in the whole population. We finish our chat discussing the opportunities and challenges of e-learning and digital collaboration, including his work in the recent digital hackathons, plus Callum's favourite resources in the smart community space. At one point, we also mentioned smart community festivals, and I say in the interview that I discussed this with Martin Tomic in his episode, but no, it was actually Heath Rafferty who I spoke with in episode 113 about smart regions. So we've linked all those episodes up in the show notes as well. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoy making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Callum. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks, Zoe. How's yourself?
Very well. Tell us where you're zooming in from.
Right now, I am sitting on an island in the middle of an island in the middle of the Baltic Sea up in Northern Europe, so in Estonia.
Yeah, wow. Oh, that sounds like a pretty nice place to be at this time.
Do you know what? It's pretty beautiful. We're hitting into summer, which means that we're hitting... last week, there was actually an extreme weather alert for Estonia because of the extreme heat. We were hitting like 25 degrees. It was massive. But I tell you what, it's beautiful right now. We have the fortune that my daughter's grandmother has a wonderful old property and adjoining a farm out here in the middle of the island. So we get the holiday out here during summer.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Okay, let's jump into this because I don't want to dream too much about sitting on island. It's pretty chilly here in Toowoomba today. But let's jump into this. Tell me about your background and what you're passionate about.
So my background. So I come from Tennant Creek in the middle of the Northern Territory. Nice. But I spent a long time traveling around Australia, traveling around the world, and then fell into IT and working with financial services, banks, NRMA, these sort of guys, getting onto the internet back in the early days, and then rolling out digitalization through their institutions. And then through my travels, I ran into Estonia, fell in love with the place, fell in love with the people. And then my partner, who's Estonian, and I, we moved back here in about 2007, something like this. Because this was a time where the energy in the country was really kicking off with Skype, which comes from Estonia, was going ballistic at the time. The government was digitalizing at a massive rate, and the energy was fantastic. So we moved back here then, and from there, while still commuting a bit to and from London for working with financial services still, I started to get into the startup community here. And I guess for the best part of 10 years now, I've been working closely with the startup community and working with the government and the people who digitalized the society here, and working out how we can spread the opportunity of digitalization and the not just the technology side of it and so forth, but the way you can actually connect up whole of society and see what emerges from that, and how we can take the experience from here in Estonia out to the rest of the world. And so I guess that's what I'm passionate about, to see how we can take the advantages of digitalizing around the world to activate people everywhere.
So interesting. And Estonia is such a, I guess, a hot topic on people, or a hot location of whenever we talk about smart cities. And I've been dying to have somebody on the podcast. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
No, thanks for having me here. Because I think, yeah, Estonia has got an amazing story behind it. For those who don't know much about it, I guess a lot of your community will know a lot about it just because of the digitalization aspect. But Estonia is quite an amazing place because it's, from a size-wise, it's about, from a land space, it's a pretty average-sized European country, right? About the size of Denmark and so forth. Population-wise, it's only 1.3 million. And it, for the second millennia, the last millennium, it was independent, I think, for about 32 years. Something like this. So they either the Swedes, the Poles, the Germans, the Prussians, the Russians, somebody was always in here occupying the place. But then it finally got its first independence back in the early 1900s, so just after World War One, and that lasted only 20 years. So then when re-independence came after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Baltic states pulling off from there, you had a country that had actually limited experience of being an independent nation. Its infrastructure had been wiped out during the Soviet period, and its level of wealth, which before the Soviet occupation, it was richer than Finland, it was on par with neighbors in Sweden and so forth. So this is its community. So it was on par with all of them, but all of that got wiped out. So it was the poorest country in Europe coming out of the occupation. But what they did, though, and again, this is a matter of how important timing is when you do things. They took the opportunity then. So instead of trying to copy what all the other Nordic states had done in building up their society, so instead of copying this sort of legacy model, which they couldn't afford and they didn't have the people to do, Estonia decided to digitalize. And this is at a time when, so early 90s, this is before the internet had really taken off. So they took a big bet that the internet was going to be a real thing that everybody could leverage. And they also, again, they didn't have the money to build all of this, or to actually get experts in from around the world to come and build it. And these ended up being fantastic things because they had to work out everything from themselves. Nobody had built a digital society before. Nobody cared about the limited money that Estonia had to offer to come in and help them do it. So they actually came up with the ideas, and then they solved all the challenges by themselves, which meant that Estonia, going from the poorest nation in Europe back in the mid-90s, is now pretty much from a wealth level, at the median level, but it has the most vibrant startup community in Europe, and is the most advanced digitalized digital society in the world. And I say that it's still the most advanced digital society in the world, even though lots of countries are jumping ahead with sort of more exciting solutions, specific solutions. Systemically, no other country has digitalized the way that Estonia has yet. And so this is why it's still a great model then for the rest of the world, because firstly, Estonians had to solve the problems for themselves. And so now throughout society, you have these amazing problem solvers and people who actually like big challenges because they know they can solve them. And secondly, they did it with no money. Everything was done locally. And so these wonderful models, particularly for emerging countries, but also for countries like Australia, like the US, like Canada, like the UK and so forth. There's elements of here that can work out how to do things with this sort of startup mindset to actually build out the digital society in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I should admit then, another thing I'm passionate about is Estonia.
Mm.
No, you might have guessed that already.
Yes, definitely sounds like it. And I cannot wait to visit one day, probably not in the very near future, but hopefully not too far away.
Well, do you know what?
My list.
You can actually become a virtual resident of Estonia. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
No? Okay, so this is really cool. So in Estonia, to Actually, so I'm going to rave on about how amazing Estonia is. I should put in a sort of a marker just to explain that, yeah, there are big problems here as well, like everywhere else. But we'll talk about all the cool stuff, at least initially. So it takes about 20 minutes to set up a company here in Estonia. You can do it all online. The taxes are very simple, flat rates and so forth. Everything's very transparent and easy to do. So what this means then is running a business here is actually a very effective and attractive proposition to a lot of people, particularly wanting to do business in Europe. So what Estonia did is said, well, do you know what? What if we could actually offer this platform, this sort of government as a platform, or to the rest of the world? And they created something called e-residency. This is back in 2015, from memory, 14, 15, 15, I think. So yeah, they basically invited the rest of the world to come and become e-residents of Estonia, which means you can become a digital citizen of Estonia without even having the right to step in here physically at all, which means you can set up your EU-based business operating from the Estonian digital platform without, again, having to set foot in Europe itself. This is really cool, actually, particularly for digital nomads, people who don't have really sort of a fixed base, constantly moving around, but need to have a reputable sort of business environment to run their business from so they can do their freelancing and so forth from there. So what was interesting about this is, well, actually two things. Firstly, the way they built it. The idea came out of a mini hackathon with the Ministry of Economics here, where one of the teams, including the then CIO of Estonia and a couple of others, came up with this idea for this e-residency platform. That would have been, I think, April that year. Within a month, the Prime Minister of Estonia and the President of Estonia had both announced internationally that Estonia was going to deliver this by November that year. So basically gave them 6 months to deliver this solution. Now, of course, as soon as they heard about it, the customs, the tax authorities, the police and border guards said, so what the hell are you doing? What? Why didn't people ask us about this? Because it's a major shock to society to all of a sudden they're going to have to deal with all these digital citizens in a way that they've never done it before, because it's always been you've got a physical person that you work with and then you create a digital identity off the base of that physical person. We're now saying that we're going to do this for people all across the world that we may not be able to vet in the same way. Now, they worked out ways to do that. And yeah, they actually delivered the first e-citizens or e-residents, were onboarded in November that year. And we now have, what's the numbers? I think there's 60, 70,000 e-residents. They've built 6, 7,000 businesses. It generates so far about 41 million euros in, so it was about a 10 million euro investment, all said and done. And so far returned about 41 million euros in taxes, direct taxes, to the Estonian state off the back of that. And what was really interesting is it was assumed that the people who'd be most interested in taking up this opportunity would be people from outside the EU who wanted to do business in the EU, particularly if they had sort of their own uncertain, unstable business environments, be it in Russia, in Ukraine at the time, across Asia, Africa, and so forth. But the country that it's been most popular with, actually, other than our neighbours in Finland, who have property and businesses here, so they like the idea that they can digitally sign all their documents and so forth without having to do anything physical. The country that actually found it most exciting was Germany. Mm. So a lot of German freelancers and entrepreneurs actually moved their businesses to Estonia because it was so much cheaper, so much more efficient with their time running their business on the Estonian platform than it was from Germany. So they themselves are still based in Germany. They still pay their taxes in Germany. They don't escape any of that sort of stuff. So it's not like a tax haven that they can come to here. But the reality is that it's much more efficient and cheaper for them to, and cost effective, I guess, for them to run their business from Estonia than it is to do it in Germany itself. So this is one of the cool things coming out of Estonia. So as I say, you can join us without actually physically coming here. Well, they do recommend physically coming here. It's absolutely beautiful, particularly this time of year when, as I say, summer's kicking in and the world is coming alive.
Yeah, no, it's definitely on my list. Maybe this time next year the borders might be open again and I might be able to come.
Let's hope so.
Okay, That's been so interesting. And I do want to dive really deeply into what's happening in Estonia, but I just want to quickly backtrack a little bit and tell us about you and how you got into this space. I know you talked about that a little bit before, but tell us how you came to be in this kind of smart community space.
So I guess it's been a gradual development. So I was playing with the startup scene here in Estonia from about 2008 or 9. And then I basically got sucked into running a startup accelerator here by my predecessor there, who was leaving but didn't tell me he was leaving. Convinced me to come in part-time to support him, building out the business community connected to the accelerator. And then 2 weeks after I joined, he came in and said, hey, by the way, I'm leaving and you're it. And so then I had to learn how to work with the government side, the business side, and the startups, and effectively pull together the whole of society around building new ideas and actually solving interesting problems. And I started to realize how effective this actually is in bringing change into place, because it's only by pulling together all of these different resources, these different ideas, and these people from different parts of society that you'll actually start coming up with genuinely ambitious, exciting new ideas. And it's only by bringing them all together that you're actually going to be able to implement them with some sort of scaled impact in there. So, for example, if you want to solve some really challenging problems, you will generally need the government involved in helping you implement and actually spread the impact of whatever you're doing. And that might be just from access to communities to changing regulations, legislation, so forth out there. You'll often need the reach and the funding from the private sector, particularly corporations, to do the same thing and actually to spread beyond your borders as well. So this is where I got into, I guess you would call the smart community space, was understanding that actually the emphasis is on, actually, I think you also talked about this in one of your previous podcasts, didn't you? The emphasis is actually on community. It's actually about the people that you pull together. And it's then once you get these inspiring ideas, you get the excitement, and you get the emergent, ideas coming from that community, then you bring in the smart technology behind to implement it. But you need people, obviously, who understand the possibilities of that technology to then excite the people who have their levers on the power and the funds to actually make the change happen.
Mm. That possibility, I think, is a really key part, because if you can't think about what is possible without being held back by what is true right now, then you can't actually harness the real, you know, the new thinking and the technology. The technology is not very useful unless you can see a new possibility. So, yeah, really like that.
Yeah, that's totally it. And also, when you are, particularly if you're in a big corporation or if you're in the government, in your day job, there is so much noise and so much complexity that you get bogged down in, that you rarely see the opportunities for doing things differently, for doing things better. And so this is why it's really cool to bring in people from the entrepreneurial society, from the startup community, or actually even outside that, from basically anywhere across civil society, who can actually come in and throw out totally new ideas, totally new angles for thinking about things. Mm-hmm. And then you start to see, oh, there is a different way to do this. We don't actually have to go through the same grind that we have been so far, because technology is now enabling us to go past that. Again, I think Estonia provides a really good example here, because the digital society here in Estonia and the whole sort of smart society, I guess, here in Estonia was really driven by the private sector. So while the government was trying to work out how to build up institutions and structures and processes and so forth, and as it was getting into that, and the private sector was coming in saying, well, do you know what? We could do this with computers, and it would be a hell of a lot faster and cheaper and more reliable than doing it the way you're doing it on paper. Mm-hmm. And then when they started doing that, they started to realize, actually, do you know what? A lot of these steps and processes, now that we can actually connect the data because it's all networked, a lot of these steps and processes that we had to get from an idea through to legislation, for example, can actually be skipped because the computers can take care of that data sharing and validation for us. Now, all we have to do is use to augment that with our own ideas, intelligence, and discussions on top of it. So, yeah, again, smart community, mainly about the people coming up, bringing in their different angles, the different perspectives, and their different skill sets to then leverage the technology that's out there.
Mm. And the community in Estonia, Is this conversation a kind of normal one to have, this digitization? Because in Australia, you know, smart city, a lot of people wouldn't even know what that is. And then even if they had heard of it before, they didn't want to engage in the conversation, which is why I changed to smart community. But even so, it's not really something the everyday citizen thinks about necessarily. But I'm wondering, in Estonia, is this something that, you know, is talked about because it's, you know, a common kind of thing that's happening throughout, you know, the whole community?
Depends which bubble you're in within the community, right? Mm. So certainly within my bubble, with the startups and with the government, it's there all the time. It's the sort of the main theme running through our conversations. But you step outside that. So when I'm at home or with friends and so forth outside that community, it doesn't come in at all. And this is what's fascinating about it, is that's just because what life is here.
Mm.
Everybody assumes they can do things digitally. Everybody assumes that there's an app to sort out whatever problem it is that they've got. I think it's more of if you have to go and do something physically, if you have to fill out a web form or something like this, people start to get upset because they don't see why they should have to do that, because the government already has the information. The agencies have the data they need to make all the decisions and so forth. Why should they have to do something? Why should they help the government to do that when they can use their brains and do it themselves? And I think that's the only time it actually comes into the conversation, because it's so normal here, because that's the way it's been it's been building for 25, 30 years now. And I think I guess the other side is that when things slow down, when the rate of progress slows for bringing in new ideas, new solutions and so forth, that's when people start to notice again as well. But the concept of digitalizing, I mean, that's normal, right?
It's really interesting. I'm keen to hear how, and I'm thinking, you know, if I'm, I don't know, living in Australia or living somewhere where, you know, you still have to fill out a paper form or whatever, what does the day in the life look like for an Estonian that had to go, I don't know, get a driver's license or something like that?
Driver's license is a really good example. So I don't know what the situation is in Australia these days, but in Estonia, to renew your driver's license, you have to, I don't know if it's every time or every second time, you have to have a health check done as well, just to make sure you're still fit to drive in there. So what happens is, this actually happened to one of my colleagues recently. So she realized that it was time to renew it. I think she got an email or something from the roads administration saying, "Oi, renew your license." So she logged into their website, and you do that using your digital identity. So in Estonia, we all have a unique identifier that is actually issued to Estonians on birth before they're given their name. There's a unique digital identifier that we use to identify ourselves to the government or to any other private services at any point. So she logs into the roads administration with her digital identity and says, "Give me a new license." They immediately come back to her on the website there and say, "You need a health check. Your previous one's expired." So they already know this information. So she says, "Cool." She clicks the next button, which says, "Book me an appointment." And she gets transferred through to book an appointment with her own GP. So all of this information is known because all the systems are connected there. So then she goes to her GP. She had her health check done with the GP. Came back to the office, and I think it was an hour and a half, 2 hours later, she had her new driver's license. It was renewed. She hadn't done anything more at that point. All she'd done is she'd gone to the GP, had the health check, everything else happened automatically. And the way that this works is you have the motor vehicle registry have her license details. The population registry, managed by the Ministry of the Interior, has all her address and contact details. And then you've got the health board that has all of her health data and details about her GP and all her medical history inside there. So when she went to the GP to have her health check there, with her permission, when the GP uploaded that data to the health registry automatically shared that with the motor vehicle registry, because it was a health check specific to getting her license. The motor vehicle registry, that came through, and they automatically then said, "Okay, we got a green check from the doctor. That was the only thing stopping us reissuing the license." Bang, license reissued. There was nobody else involved in that process, and especially not her. She just got a notification a couple of hours later. Boom, your license is ready. And that was it.
You mentioned permission. I think that's really important, and particularly different cultures around the world talking about data and data privacy and all those type of things. What are some of the, I guess, like, you know, medical history, for example, do organizations only get the relevant information? Is there, I guess, checks and balances in place where you can say yes, no, you can have this, but you can't have this, etc.?
Yes. So, and I guess this is in the context of the My Health Record in Australia as well. Yeah. So here we have any activities in the within the medical system here or within the health services here will be, they have their own computer systems, their own solutions, but the records then get uploaded into our central health registry. Now, within that registry, I can say by default that, for example, my doctor has access to this information, but I can either at a whole registry level or whole profile level or with specific instances in there add or remove people from having access to it. So I have full control over who has access to the data in my data in the health registry at a granular level. And also, I think on top of that, which is really important, is I can also see who has accessed my data. So it's not just a matter of I can say yes or no. I can also see who has accessed it and why they accessed it. And if I don't like the fact that they've been there, and I can, they can't convince me, or they can't convince a judge here in the courts that they had good reason to be in there, then they will be penalized, can even be locked up, no matter who they are in society, if they're breaching that trust. And that trust is obviously fundamental to being able to build this digital society, because if you can't trust, because digital society is built on shared data, right? And if you can't trust that that's being protected, that you've got control over it, then it's not going to work. And I guess this is one of the limitations that we still have in Australia. We talk about, or Australians talk about, the Australian government talks about, it's got a different social license to operate than we have here in Australia. And it's true. And that's largely based on the fact that even though we're very similar societies, we're both liberal democracies, we both come from a European, Northern European cultural background. In Estonia, by and large, society trusts not necessarily government, but government agencies with their data, because historically the agencies have proved, firstly, that they can be trusted with the data, and secondly, that they can create value for us from that data through automating all the services, through getting rid of the friction in day-to-day life. The Australian government has Australian governments have struggled doing that. In fact, they've gone in the other direction and increasingly lost people's trust, because they haven't been able to create value from the data for people. They have actually spent a lot of money on big fail projects. That being said, I think New South Wales is doing quite well in this point at the moment, aren't they? Because I think Dominello is at least leading the team that is rolling out lots of point valuable services based on connecting up people's data. And hopefully that'll build up the trust over time to be able to do stuff that's more ambitious.
Yeah, I agree. And I think trust is such an important thing, and that social license to operate is key. And we see it time and time again. And it's interesting because I think we talk about how important it is, but then sometimes we don't follow up with actions that create trust, I suppose. And I'm not necessarily talking about the Australian government, just kind of globally at the moment. It's such an interesting topic. I think we could have a whole podcast on that as well.
Quite a few, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure lots of people are. And I also think inclusion is such a key component, you know, of this. And I'm really keen to hear about how Estonia has, I guess, included people that may not have been digitally literate, or has there been programs in place to kind of bring people up to speed, or is it just, you know, that there's so much value to be had that people are doing this because it's the way, you know, that they see so much value in it?
It's a bit of everything, isn't it? But I think talking about inclusiveness is a really important point here when we talk about digital society and digital society, smart communities. To me, we're actually talking about pretty much the same thing here, but exactly what that is. So to me, a digital society is one which is where you've got, again, the whole of society, not just parts of it, but the whole of society is connected through data flows that actually then people can build the services and amazing new ideas on top of. But it does mean that, as you say, the whole of society needs to be able to access those services. They need to be able to understand how to use them. And they also need to be able to contribute to what gets built, what sort of ideas emerge from those platforms. So, yeah, again, this was largely driven by – actually, no, it really was private and public sector who got involved early days in Estonia with this one. So once the – as a community, they decided they're going to go digital, then the government invested heavily into something called Tiger's Leap. This was a program in the mid-90s where actually a really good – so the government invested heavily in getting internet access and digital literacy into schools from primary age already in the mid-90s. So I think from 95, 96, 96, children from 7 years old were already being taught how to code, how to use computers, but actually how to build stuff on computers as well. In 91, only half the country had access to telephone lines. By 96, every school was connected to the internet and kids were on computers using them. So in the space of 5 years. So this was the Tiger's Leap, where the government invested very heavily in that digital literacy program for in the education system. But at the same time, private sector was very keen to jump on top of this as well, particularly banks, because, say, Estonia is size-wise a pretty average-sized European nation, but population-wise is pretty small. So people are pretty spread out around the country, and the banks didn't want to have a retail outlet in every little town in the country. It's just too expensive and the returns weren't there. What they did want to do is get people online and using the online services from the banks. So in 96, we had the first internet banks here in Estonia. And the private sector, I forget what it was called, but they actually invested in traveling around the country and building community events where they would actually teach in these big sort of festive events. They would teach small villages all around the country how to use computers, what the internet looked like, this sort of thing. And that was there was no public support for no public service support for that. There was purely a private sector initiative to make that happen. So you see, there was investment both on the government and the private sector side. And nowadays, what's pulling it forward then is really from the startup community, because a large part of the private sector has already digitalized enough from their perspective to take advantage of the economies that you can get and the efficiencies you can get from delivering via the internet. The government, unfortunately, has underinvested for probably the last 10 years or so in the stuff that they're doing beyond, I guess, the last big thing was e-residency. So it's the startup community now who are forcing their way into big corporations and into the government to say, hey, there are so many more cool things that we can do, playing with data, using frontier tech and so forth. And they're now pulling the community forward there. So, yeah. So back to your question about inclusiveness. There was big investment into getting the infrastructure in place. And there was big investment both by the private sector and the public sector in building out the skills to use that. And this is actually still ongoing. I think Estonia is still obviously upgrading its infrastructure. I think that the literacy is pretty much there for anybody who wants it, who wants to use the system, the solutions, and to the point that I think 99% of Estonians have digital identities and use their digital identities. Nearly 50% of society, and not just Estonians in Estonia, but across the world, actually used internet voting for the last big elections. They were actually the voting for European Parliament members from Estonia in the middle of last year. So to me, that's inclusion, because you're now getting not only people within Estonia itself, but Estonians across the world and now getting easy access to still contribute into society here. And by the end of this year, within Estonia itself, nobody will be further than 1.5 kilometers from a fiber connection. And in fact, most people already have 100 plus megabit access to the internet, which is, or actually gigabits available for most people in the cities if they want it, which is also affordable and stable.
And I think that's so important, affordability and that reliability as well. And it's never been more important during this time. If you didn't have good internet connection during COVID time, then you were pretty in the dark, I guess, with knowing what's going on. But also if you could work, if it was possible to work from home, you had to have that internet connectivity. And I think it's really exploded the digital divide, particularly in Australia, I guess, around the world as well. So, yeah, really, really interesting. And I love the idea of a festival because I think a smart community festival would be amazing. And I was talking to somebody else on the podcast a while ago, and I'm going to have to go back and listen to it. I think it was Martin Tomich, but I can't remember exactly. But anyway, and you know, we know that we've made it when we're having a festival that the community is involved in, and that I think increasing that digital literacy through something like that would be something really, really powerful, and particularly in regional areas in Australia, I'm thinking as well. So yeah, no, I love that idea, and increasing that digital literacy is really, really important. And the data literacy as well. I know you spoke about data a lot as well, and knowing where your data is. I mean, it's hot topic here in Australia and everywhere. But I think we need to understand more what's happening with our data and where we're giving it. And I think it's coming because particularly kids who are learning how to code at school, they're starting to ask these questions, right? And questions we should have probably been asking for many years. And I think it'll be demanded. So yeah, really interesting times ahead, I think.
It is. It's on the data literacy side. You're right that we should have been asking these questions a long time ago, but often they don't even occur. And I have to admit, to me, having sort of been within the IT industry and sort of connecting up all the data systems for a very long time, I didn't really think about it until I started working with very early stage startups. And we started to think about, okay, well, where are the growth opportunities in what you're building here? Where's the value you can create from there? And so much of it actually came from data and personal data, and how, do you know what, with that information there, you can really, really, I guess, market hard. You can do all your growth hacking directly to people because you know so much about them. You know what they want. You can push that straight to them. And obviously, we were thinking very much from a positive perspective of, hey, because we understand these people really well, we know what their problems are. We can actually help them solve these problems. But that can easily be twisted very quickly, can't it? To, okay, so we know these people really well. So now we understand what their trigger points are. We can now actually create the information sphere around them to trigger those points and actually take them off in different directions. So people are no longer, even though they think they're making their own choices, we're actually pushing them down that path because the information they're receiving is designed to trigger those particular mindsets, those particular decisions. And so we start to lose control of our world around us. But that, as I say, didn't really occur to me until I was working with these early stage startups, looking at the data that was available and try to work out what we could do from this in a positive perspective or positive aspect, and not really thinking about, oh, this could actually be abused pretty badly. And now we've seen in recent years how bad it has been abused, particularly with the Brexit campaign in the UK and other governments owning the Philippines, the US, Russia, and so forth, taking advantage of all of this to push out their more sort of populist messages. So data literacy, really important. But also, Zoe, you're talking about the regional communities in Australia. And it made me think, you had a podcast a short while ago where I forget who your guest was, but he was talking about a school, I believe, in Nara, who decided actually with the lockdown that they were going to have to print all the lessons off on paper and distribute those to the families, just because the access to the internet was so unreliable for so many of the families there. I thought, well, that's shocking in this day and age, that should be necessary. But e-learning is now a fascinating opportunity and space here. And Australia, again, you think about it, Australia could actually take a bit of a lead here because we've been doing distance learning for half a century or more. With, do you know about the School of the Air?
My sister, she learnt music and French via distance. I grew up in a small town in Queensland. So yeah, and that was just kind of, I mean, I wouldn't call it a normal thing. It was still kind of a unique thing, but it was pretty, just wasn't anything advanced that we would think about and talk about as something that is super innovative or anything like that. It was just like, oh, well, we don't have the resources right here, but actually we have them and you can access them over school. Yeah,
exactly. And this is actually, a lot of innovation seems to come from that as well, that you have a problem and actually if you engage the right people, then the solution starts to become pretty obvious because people know what's possible. As you said before, people know what's possible. And then it just, once you do it, it becomes daily life. And so if you think that if Australia had this, it was doing this, actually, I don't even know when it started, but I know it was common in the 70s already out in the territory. So if we were doing that then, why have we not spun forward? Because these communities are still out there who still need the support. And Australia's always invested heavily into education, so, or at least prioritised education. So why not take this opportunity to work out great ways of e-learning? Mm. And even here in Estonia, this was a big topic because my daughter is 10 and we're now on summer holidays here. Here they get, these kids are so lucky, they get 3 months of back-to-back summer holidays, which is why we're out on the island now. But I guess the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks of school was done from home. So the school, when we went into lockdown here. And being digital, obviously Estonia transitioned very quickly into that space, which meant that she was immediately doing everything online, doing video classes and so forth. And that was great. That was really great. But what I did notice is that even though she was busy and she was doing a lot of stuff, her rate of learning actually went down during this time, because there's still a challenge in teaching, generating that engagement that you get in the classroom that teachers really need to help their students, generating that at scale remotely. And so somebody needs to work this out. And I know that there are people here in Estonia who, again, startup community, who have been saying for years now they're not happy with the education system here. Because even though Estonia is, do you know the PISA rankings for education around the world?
No, I don't.
It's where they, I think it's a UN metric.
Oh, yep.
And they get a representative bunch of 15-year-olds from each country. And they assess them particularly for the STEM subjects to see where they lie relative to the rest of the world. And so Estonia is number 4 in the world, number 1 in Europe in the PISA rankings. But the startup community, so the government says, yay, aren't we awesome? We rock. The startup community says, lagging indicators, mate. That doesn't tell us what's going to happen in the coming future. And they're very worried that actually we have a legacy education system here. And by legacy, I mean stuff that many parts of the world would be very excited to have, that for Estonia has already been around sort of 15, 20 years, and they feel the need to move forward. And I think e-learning is where this is. It's trying to work out, the big step will come from working out how to create that engagement between teachers and students remotely and at scale. So they can actually still teach full classrooms and so forth, or that number of children, but still provide them the personalized attention they need to help with their learning processes.
Mm.
So big opportunity for Australia here.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's been such a, you know, we've gone online and, you know, it's something I've been talking about to some of my colleagues and people in this space, is that going, I guess, digital literacy is very different to digital delivery, and it's very different to digital engagement. So all these things where we used to kind of, digital was just like a catch-all phrase for everything, and oh, I like technology, or I like digital, and blah, 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 whatever. But it's so different and so nuanced that I think we'll start to have really rich and different conversations now moving forward, because we realize that, you know, being an influencer on, you know, social media channel or whatever is very different actually to, well, between channels, for example, but also very different to digital consulting, very different to keynote speaking, or very different to delivering and engaging in that, a message that, you know, has really deep and rich technical, I don't know, elements or something like that. And I think we got a bit mixed up that, you know, everything, anyone online or anyone doing something well online could convert that into, you know, a paid work or something like that. But actually it's very, very, very different. And I think in our smart communities moving forward, we'll start to have those, I guess, more meaningful conversations about the differences in all the different elements of digital, because it's not just like one thing, the internet. It's very, very different. So yeah, no, really, really interesting stuff. And I think education is really fascinating and such an interesting future, I suppose, of how this will shift and change, and then things that won't change and stay the same as well. Yeah, so really, really interesting globally.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I guess we also have to respect the fact that as smart and wonderful as humans are, our brains do not evolve at the same pace as our technology. So we have to understand that even though the opportunities are there, we need to make sure that humans, our brains can take advantage of them as well, which is, as you say, about the difference between delivering content digitally and actually engaging with it and taking advantage of it, a very different thing.
And that's so true. And I think, and thanks for bringing that up too, because also the way that our brains ingest digital is different, right? And, you know, I know there's lots of talk about Zoom fatigue and all those type of things, and they're real things, right? You know, we've dealt with fatigue in driving, we've dealt with, you know, other issues like ergonomics, for example, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be a whole new series of challenges and problems that we're going to have to deal with when we move into an even more digital world. And it's going to be really fascinating stuff.
Totally. And it's a wonderful space.
Okay. We've been chatting for ages and I'm really, really loving this. So let's try and wrap up. We talked a lot about Estonia and it's been awesome. And maybe we'll have to do another podcast because I really want to go a bit deeper into what you do. But let's talk about the future and tell us, what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Interesting one. Well, I think, as I say, either it's a sort of a hottish topic, e-learning still isn't being understood well enough, or the potential and the challenges around e-learning aren't being talked about enough. I think, again, coming from my space around the entrepreneurial society and digital societies, is that I think too many attempts at digitalization now are getting bogged down in trying to adapt digitalization to legacy hierarchies, organizational structures, and so forth, legacy social structures. So maybe that's what's not being discussed enough, is about how digitalization is actually changing social structures. Give an example. So recently, in response to actually the lockdown here in Estonia, the government went looking for new ideas for not just responding to the lockdown and not just responding to the crisis, but how we build back better from that, how we get back, come back much stronger and prepare sort of for the future world from that. And as we do it here in Estonia, we immediately said, hey, let's do a hackathon. So literally within 45 minutes, the government had fully signed up to doing an online hackathon for the first time here. Even though we'd done lots of sort of physical hackathons, this was the first online hackathon. And that was a roaring success, that when we brought together again the government, the startup sector and the corporate sector, like the telcos and the banks, all together in a space to quickly solve problems around the immediate crisis and what comes next. We had, I think, we had 10 times the usual participants. We had people joining from 20 countries, even though we'd actually only put out the word through our local community here. We had people joining from 20 countries into this 48-hour event. And off the back of the 48-hour event, a third of the prototypes that were built were then implemented live by the government to solve sort of immediate challenges that they had with the crisis and the lockdown. So then off the back of that, that actually triggered a whole movement where I think now 70 of these hackathons have been done around the world. We've reached 250,000, 300,000 people, loads and loads of solutions. But more importantly, we've actually got people connecting from across the world to share their ideas, to support one another, to build solutions together. So we're now crossing all these international boundaries that are in place, these artificial boundaries we've put in place physically. Digital is allowing us to connect everybody up in one space from all over the world at the same time to work on the same problems. But where we ran into a challenge. So then off the back of the sort of this massive wave of Hack the Crisis hackathons that raced across the world from Estonia, we then built something called the Global Hack. And this Global Hack brought together, in the end, I think 15,000 active participants. Can you imagine what Slack was like? It was a nightmare trying to get everybody talking in here. But so we had 15,000 people from across the world actively working together on projects, on prototypes that they built across a 48-hour period to solve problems in their parts of the world, or things that they got excited about. So we had one team that had one person from Japan, one person from Kenya, two people from Ghana, and one person from Dubai, who'd never met one another, all working together on the same project, being supported by mentors from Sri Lanka, from Estonia, from Sweden, from Georgia, and so forth. So we actually had this whole international community coming together, excited to actually solve problems and work on problems together. But what we found is when we ran the Estonian Hack the Crisis hackathon, and then when Latvia, who was also involved in running the Estonia one, ran their hackathon a couple of days later, and Germany and so forth all took all this, there was really serious local government and national government engagement in those programs, which meant that the ideas as they were developed and the problems as they were raised in the hackathon. Government was there, public service was there. So they were not only being able to provide some sort of intelligence as to what was and wasn't possible with the new ideas that were coming out, but they're also learning of where the real problems are in society, what the people on the street are actually facing as problems, and then seeing the ideas that are coming through, and they're already then engaging with these same people to solve those problems in there. So that was fantastic, and that meant, as I say, in Estonia, 35% in the end or whatever of the projects went live within the first week with big government support to do that. Similarly in Latvia and Poland and so forth. When we went global, we found it very difficult to get government engagement because there's no structure for governments to actually care, national governments to care that much about international society as a whole. So this is something that we haven't nailed yet. We had wonderful partners from the UN, the World Health Organization, European Commission, all these sort of guys, and the tech ones, Slack and Zoom and so forth, all very highly engaged. But national governments stayed out of the conversation, which meant that they weren't able to learn from it. They weren't able to engage with their own civil sector, and they weren't able to then help implement these solutions locally. So I think this is a challenge, an opportunity again, because we can now bring everybody together around shared problems and shared opportunities, but we don't have the structures in place to then implement what they learn and what they the solutions they create locally with government support.
Yeah.
So again, I guess I see this more of an opportunity. It is a challenge, but it's a wonderful opportunity. If we can nail that, then we can really, really scale innovation globally.
Okay. It's been so great to chat with you, Callum. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I have two last questions here, hopefully pretty easy to answer. So while we're wrapping up, tell us about some of your favorite smart city or smart community resources that you like to read, watch, listen to, people, places, etc.
Well, obviously, I'm becoming a very big fan of your podcast. It gets me, it's some great conversations there, and actually gets my head back into what's happening in Australia. Because I guess I've been away for 20 years now. Obviously, visiting a lot, but I've been living away for 20 years now. So I'm very much outside the Australian bubble and very much inside the Estonian bubble. So it's great to get that. I like reading stuff from, I say I'm pulling away from social media because I'm finding it sort of mainly marketing and wasting a lot of time, but more and more into going into the long reads, the analysis sections within the papers to find out again. They're not smart community specific. What they do is tell you about community though and tell you about society as a whole. And if you've got an idea of the potential for the different technologies and the opportunities there, then you can actually start reflecting on how they can contribute to solving these problems or creating the opportunities for others to take advantage of out there. I know this is really old school, but books. There's so much value in books. A really good one it's a couple of years old now, I think. I think it's Jamie Suskind, who writes, it's called, I think, Future Politics. Have you heard of that one?
No, I'll have to check it out.
But really in your space, because actually what it talks about is it's all about data. Well, actually, it's all about power. And it actually helped me understand my own personal gut level irrational, which doesn't mean it was wrong, but an unreasoned opposition to things like Australia Card and so forth in Australia. So, and why there's a resistance to digital identity in Australia is he talks about three elements of power or three types of power. One is the power of force, coercion, to make you do what I want you to do. One of those is actually about scrutiny, the ability for you to know that I'm watching what you're doing all the time, which will make you sort of be more conformist. And I think this is where the big resistance is in Australia. It's this power of scrutiny that we don't want to hand over to the government. And then there's the power of influence, which is creating the information spheres around people. And this is where the big threat is going forward. And this, I think, is very much in your space, because you're talking about all that power is actually in the data. So if you understand people, particularly if you understand them better than themselves, then you can actually start manipulating them quite easily, because you can start providing the information that they need to make the decisions that you want them to make going down the path. Amazon, Google, and governments are buying into this big time. So I think understanding these sort of challenges is really, really important for us to then reflect on not only the potential for digital and the wonderful things it can do, but how we need to design it so it doesn't get abused.
No, I'll definitely add that to my reading list. Thank you. And something I've been, yeah, very interested in. And I think it's going to become more and more pressing very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Okay, one last question, and very easy. How can people connect with you?
So this one I can answer quickly. So my email address is callum@digitalpath.ee, and that's Callum with one L. So callum@digitalpath.ee, or just hit me on LinkedIn. There is also, just a warning, there's another Callum Cameron, also spelled exactly the same way, who works with the World Wide Web Foundation. He is not me.
Okay.
And I point that out because I had a chat with him the other day. We constantly receive contact requests for one another.
Yes.
He once received airline tickets that were meant for me. So I think this confusion happens.
Well, we'll put the right link in the show notes so people can click away and find you. And it's been so great to chat with you. And we definitely need to have another conversation sometime soon. So we'll do that. And enjoy your island and the weather. It sounds beautiful. And look forward to our next conversation.
It is. And Zoe, thank you very much for having me on here. It's been a great chat.
No worries. We will definitely talk soon. And bye for now.
Okay, bye. Take
care. Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're trying to deal with disruption, not sure what technologies to buy, need to facilitate genuine collaboration, then we can help. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community/consulting.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.